darkness, my old friend.
I come to talk.
I came to talk to you again.
No, we need to start with a different song.
Well, let's start. What song are we going to sing for you guys today?
I actually prepared a song. I have a note card. I'm showing Steph my note card on the camera right now. Okay, so some of you guys might be aware that it's a magical time of the year in Brazil right now.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is. It is a magical time.
I rarely talk Portuguese in this podcast, do I? So for the start of this episode, I'm going to recite a little song as a poem. Are you guys ready? I'm just going to cry. It's beautiful. A pipa do vovô não sai mais. A pipa do vovô não sobe mais. Apesar de fazer muita força, o vovô foi passado para trás. A pipa do vovô não sobe mais.
Yeah. A sad tale of a grandpa and his kite.
Okay, so yeah, this is about penises. Anyways, very appropriate for this very sad case, but I mean, we gotta laugh a little bit because we're not gonna laugh a lot throughout the episode. Anyways, who are you?
I am Stephanie. Who are you?
I am Carol. Yeah. And this is Suspiria, a true crime podcast.
Hello, friends and enemies. Hello. I know you're listening, especially the enemies. They love to follow us.
No. So, no, they're all friends. No enemies. It's a wonderful world. Wonderful, wonderful world. Just one word that I cannot say is world. Anyways.
I can say world, but you know what I can't say unless I say it in slow motion? World War II.
I just think I try to say world.
So I'm always World War II. World War.
The Second World War. Yeah. Still complicated for me. Anyways, big trigger warning. Flashing lights, all red flags popping up for this case. This is a true crime podcast. We always cover pretty dark topics, but this is going to be an especially dark episode. This is going to be a serial rape case. And I mean, it's more than that. It's more interesting, but I mean, it's sometimes you like to bring cases that don't actually involve any deaths. There's no dying in this case. Not even the main guy, the criminal, he's not dead. Spoilers. But, all the red flags, if you feel uncomfortable with these kinds of topics, please don't listen. We don't want to cause no one any psychological harm. So, yeah, we have plenty of episodes that you might like better than this one. So, yeah.
Go listen to Menegheti. There's no death. Menegheti, no death, yeah. People. No death people. No dead people.
No dead people.
Nothing. Yeah. Just listen to that.
All right. So with this case, I'll ask for a little bit of patience from you guys because as much as we like the story to be 100% about the victims and to tell only the story through the victims' voices as much as possible, sometimes, you know, I mean, I think that with this case, it wouldn't be a fair reporting of the facts because we could just gloss over who the guy was and just say that he was very famous and rich and whatnot, but that would not be enough. I think that to fully understand the victims, their trauma, why they didn't come forward, certain aspects of the investigation and the overall dimension that this case took, we need a good deal of background information and context. So this is why I'm putting this little disclaimer here so it doesn't seem like we're praising the guy for his talents or whatnot or saying that he's smart or whatever. All the info I included here is indirect relation to the case or something that helps understand his personality and why he is the way he is. So we always try to underline and highlight the victims on this podcast, but sometimes it's hard because of the lack of information. But because of the numbers of victims that the guy has, it's like hundreds and hundreds of victims. And, you know, to respect a lot of their privacy, because I don't know if they really like to have this kind of content being repeated, reiterated out there with their names and whatnot. We're not going to go too deep into their lives, but we will include some of their testimonies and their stories said on their own words when it comes time to, you know, have that. And also, when we do come to descriptions and more the down and dirty portions of this and the testimonies, we will warn you. And if you don't want to listen to it, you can skip. Still a lot of content. It's going to be a long episode. So, yeah. So I want to give some, we never do that, but I want to give some credits to the people that I kind of got all this information from, because it's a big case and there's no like one source with everything. So first off, Belle Rodriguez, she did a two-parter on her YouTube channel about this case, and she actually read books about this, and we don't do that, so that's why I want to credit her, because it was really, really helpful. So if you're a Portuguese speaker, go check her out. It's Belle Rodriguez. So the ID channel special they did on this case was also really helpful for us. The news stories done by Fantástico and Domingo Espectacular, and of course Wikipedia for dates and names and such, because I don't know why I always go with Wikipedia, because you know, it's
you know what makes me really mad when I like look things up, like, and like I'll watch a documentary or like a video on mm-hmm. a case, and then I'll be like, okay, typing it up, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'll go on Wikipedia, and let's say the murder happened on January 1st, and then Wikipedia is like, so the murder on January 29th. I'm yeah. like, okay, so which one is true, mm-hmm. Wikipedia or all the videos that yeah. I watched?
No, it's, I mean,
so frustrating.
I think that it depends. You know, a lot of the times, the ID channel specials, they like deal with the investigators, and yeah. I feel like the dates that they say match more often than yeah. like news reporters and stuff.
Yeah.
So I always go with Wikipedia when in doubt, because guys, you guys would be so impressed the variety of dates that these cases have. Like, it's like, did they even happen? Like, it's fucking obnoxious. Oh, and yeah. I didn't mention that the victims' testimonies, they're all available on YouTube. I didn't talk to anyone too for this case. I don't, yeah, this is all just me and my computer, no talking to no person. Anyways,
Jorge Abdelmassi was born on October 3rd, 1946 in São João da Boa Vista, São Paulo, Brazil.
Yay.
Although yeah, your state.
Another
here
one.
As usual. Although him and his family moved to Campinas, São Paulo, when he was at a fairly young age. His parents were Lebanese immigrants, and he had a brother and a sister. He had a roughly comfortable childhood money-wise, with his family being always close to all the most influential people in Campinas. Him and his siblings always studied at the most traditional and expensive schools there were. Again, always surrounded by influential people. He was right there with the kids of the 1%. Jorge goes a step further even when he asks his dad to study at one of the best schools in the country, Colégio Bandeirantes in São Paulo.
Mm-hmm.
Not familiar with that, but
yeah. I mean, I've
to those of you
went there, but I mean, it's, I'm biased talking about schools in São Paulo because I've been through so many, but I mean,
Bandeirantes. Oh, you've was, gone to this school?
Huh? No, not
did
that
you go
one.
To the same
not that
oh,
one.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
I mean, we kind of,
because I was like, oh my god, you started with the murder.
Yeah, we kind of thought about it, but it was kind of like too expensive and too coxinha for us, you know. So we just yeah, we just went to a community school instead. Anyways, I'm gonna tell you guys that story in another time, because this is not this is not gonna so, be a sidebar episode. Anyway, go on.
When Hajer graduated high school and joined the first med class of Unicamp, which is like another very famous university in Brazil, and it's in Campinas. He specialized in urology and graduated in 1968 at the age of 24, which is crazy. Can you imagine having a medical degree at 24?
I know.
Like, I can barely imagine having a high school degree at 24.
I know.
Anyway, so from the beginning and all the way through his college and career, he was always like hella strategic. He would only befriend people that he could get something out of. And that was always something related to the high society elites, all building up to his goal, which at that point was to have rich and influential people as his patients. Well, my goal is to have rich people as my husbands and then divorce them and keep the money.
Oh, man. So Hozier becomes one of the first doctors to actually perform vasectomies in Brazil. And even though they were really taboo at the time, they became really popular with rich men because they were just trying to avoid scandals, to be honest. So, yeah, at this point, Hozier already has a whole network of rich people that he's friends with. So when he starts doing the vasectomies, all he gets is more rich people on his fucking table. You know what I mean? So it just piles up. Like, the connections he's making just, like, triplicate, like, really fast. So one of his personal friends was Dr. Patrick Steptoe. Do you know that name? Of course we don't.
Steptoe.
Because we're ignorant, but now we know. Okay, this is some cool trivia about IVF, sorry. So he is one of the in vitro fertilization's pioneers. No, he's one of the pioneers. I cannot say that. Pioneers. Pioneers. He was one of the pioneers of IVFs, in vitro fertilizations. Yeah. And in 1978, he delivered the first IVF baby into this world. Her name is Louise Brown, and she was born in England. Nothing to do with Brazil, I know, but just, you know,
the more friends. You know.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't like deliver her, but you know what I'm saying, like doing the whole.
Are we legally allowed to insert the more you know clip, like just the audio of it?
This is
Judas. Can that become our new thing? Every time we give out like interesting facts, we just play the more you know.
I mean, we should totally do that, like on every episode, just include random barely related facts. I mean, this is very related. We're on the story here, okay?
Yeah.
So the more when, you know. Yeah. So when Louise is born, the world goes absolutely bananas. I mean, it's obvious that Roger is just sitting in his office, wide-eyed. You know, probably couldn't sleep for days thinking about all the rich people that want the test tube babies for themselves. And even better, what if he's the first to bring that technology to the Tupini Kings, to Brazil? Can you imagine? He would be forever
the shit
with all the glory, laurels, and all the red carpets, everything. So... there was another doctor, though, that was actually one of his friends, mentors, I think, that was very interested in bringing IVF to Brazil for better reasons. His name was Dr. Nakamura, and he had already been working with Roger for years with urology and stuff. So although Roger did want all the glory to himself, he was very aware of and kind of expecting that there would be a backlash as soon as the IVF started. And when it was all new, that kind of procedure was very criticized and still is criticized by religions and religious people. And he's very religious himself, Hozier. So he thought it was better to
the
wait
irony.
And see what happens to Dr. Nakamura before he risks ruining his own name. So again, he wasn't after anything else but prestige and success. And eventually something else, but we'll get there. So his suspicions were right. Nakamura was dragged through the mud. He was even fired from his job at another very prestigious university, PUC, that's PUC, because the board saw that there was no place for a transgressor at a Catholic institution. Moment of silence. That fucking sucks. So, I mean, they kind of had nothing to do with the whole thing because Nakamura was like paying out of his own pocket for everything, doing it all in his own clinic. But just because he was doing it, they didn't find it acceptable. So after years of failed attempts, in October 7th, 1984, the first IVF baby is born in Brazil. And Nakamura finally gets all the applause he deserves. Abdamasi is pissed, of course, and at that point, he's still working at Campinas, but he's trying to transfer his whole web network spider bullshit to São Paulo. Mm-hmm. He opens a clinic there and divides his time between the two cities. So Campinas is like an hour, not even, from São Paulo. It's like the same thing, like you don't know when one ends and one starts, you know?
Yeah, people always make it seem like it's so close. Because I have a friend who studied at Unicampi. Mm-hmm. And she lived in São Paulo. She was like, oh, yeah, I just drive to school. And I was like, oh, that close? Okay, whatever. Yeah.
It's like no issue at all. It's really close. So the clinic was located at the Jardins neighborhood, which is very, 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 very affluent, at the corner of Brazil and Argentina. And, it's interesting, right? There's like this whole neighborhood that has, I think they call it the Americas neighborhood, that has all the streets are names of countries. It's interesting, right?
I recently found out that there's a section in Rhode Island, mm-hmm. in Providence, where the streets are named after states. So there's like New York, Virginia, blah, blah, blah. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Interesting.
So his career keeps climbing up. He does have a good success rate, and the technique is being improved. He's making advancements. He's also creating a name for himself, not only with the elites, but also with the media. He has big newspapers and magazines talking about him, and he even writes a book in the early 90s titled Anything for a Baby. Ha, that's the pun. Okay.
Yeah.
He then transitions to only performing fertility treatments and doing some scientific work on the matter. While Dr. Nakamura's philosophy was treating infertility and finding out the root issues before proceeding with the IVFs, Abdelmassih had a different approach. He focused on numbers and numbers only, and bragged constantly about how many babies he had created and how many patients were seeing him, aka, look at the shit ton of money that I'm making. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Fucking attention whore. I don't like attention whores.
Yeah.
Okay. But some people do call me an attention whore. So does that mean I don't like myself? Okay.
I mean, we're calling people attention whores. You know, it's fucking us. It's broadcasting exactly. Your voices.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He only seemed focused on making as many babies as possible with no concern about the psychological and physical ramifications that he was growing within his patients. Mm-hmm. In 1996, something magical happens. A guy and his wife walk into Rogers Clinic. You know, you might have heard of him. Edson Arantes do Nascimento, a.k.a. Pelé, not yes. Pelé. It's not Pelé, okay?
Pelé.
If the next time someone calls Pelé, Pelé, in front of me, I'm going to lose my shit, okay?
That
it's just like...
The little thing on top of the E is not decoration. It's a sound.
Yeah.
You need to make it.
Yeah. It's like when people are like, oh, do you like Neymar? I'm like, who the fuck is Neymar? I know Neymar. And I don't like him. But Neymar means nothing to me. Anyway.
Right over.
So... rant over. The couple goes through the treatments and ends up with twins. Hodges' mm-hmm. name, of course, is on every single newscast magazine, newspaper. The story about the twins is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Insert Dwight. I love a good set of twins gif here. I love that episode.
Yeah,
because like Pelé is like probably the most famous person in Brazil still. So
Pelé and Xuxa, which
yeah. This is when Roger finally gets all that he has always wanted. The rich and the famous hoarding to his clinic to get their babies. He works with several other famous clients like Fátima Bernardes and William Bonner, who were like the biggest couple in like anchor news people for forever. And then they broke up and I lost my faith in love.
No, have you seen the pictures of her and her boyfriend now?
I mean, they're cute, but
no,
like
the best. I mean,
yeah, but I mean,
yeah, it's like you want them to stay together, but also you want them to be happy, you know, because they're there on your television every day. You grow attached to them, you know.
So another famous client of his was Gretchen, who is the meme queen.
Gretchen.
She was in the Swish. Was it Swish? Swish. Yeah, video Katy Perry. So that's Gretchen.
The lady.
She's like super famous. Yeah. The clinic starts making $1 million a month, at least. Can you imagine making... I can't even imagine making $1 million in my lifetime, let alone in a month.
I know, right? Like,
are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And Roger, of course, becomes friends with big, 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 big time people like Abby, Roberto Carlos, the singer, not the soccer player, probably, and Amaury Jr. So Amaury Jr., he is like... He is a very famous, like, TV personality.
Is he dead already?
So no, he's like in his 70s, I think. So basically, he had this show where he would basically go to rich people's parties and interview them. That was it.
Yeah, like all his show is just parties. And one of those parties is hosted by Abdelmacy. There is pictures of that on YouTube. The first, ooh, yes, not pictures. Pictures on YouTube is great, but videos on YouTube. Yeah. Abby shows up holding like a baby doll, and she's like, I finally got my baby kind of thing. Abby's the best, but yeah, they were really close friends, Abby and Abdelmacy.
I did not know that. Yeah.
He even got the first baby to show up at his party. Yeah, Louise Brown, she's there looking like, not a mess, but she's looking like she doesn't belong at all. She's like, what are those people?
She's like, what is this? Why are these people somebody? No, but like, Amaury Jr.'s TV show, that's like my life goal, just to get paid to go to parties and like interview drunk people, because like most of them are like super drunk. So sometimes they'll be like saying shit that makes no sense, and you're just looking at them like, how pathetic. But it's fun at the same time. So
I've been trying to think of like a equivalent to Abby in the American media, and I cannot think of anyone.
Wouldn't it be like Diane Sawyer, maybe?
I don't know who that is. I can think of anyone, because also I don't know any people, any persons, you know? Like, she's nothing like, you know, Oprah or something. She's more like...
Yeah, she's different.
She's if Ellen DeGeneres was a very rich old lady, you know what I mean?
And had a TV show at night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the clinic already has some good marketing tactics at the beginning, but they were more focused on the treatments themselves, because they're all the new fad, IVF, test tube babies, everything. So when all this stuff happens, when Hozier actually becomes famous, what starts selling for the clinic is Hozier himself. He is the celebrity doctor. He's friends with everyone's idols. He's on TV all the time. That's too, you know, he's always, you turn the TV on, he's there on everyone's show. It's, you know, it's a very, very effective way to make money and to market yourself, you know. So he doesn't have all his eggs on the same basket, no pun intended. He invests.
Sorry, really wasn't the intention. Now I'm not going to stop giggling.
He invests money on the money he made with the clinic on big plots of land in the region of Jabuticabal and Avaré in the countryside of São Paulo. His properties are... Yeah, Stephanie just like waved her head like, yeah, I don't know.
I have no idea where that is.
Yeah. So his properties are valued to be worth tens of millions of reais. And he becomes a orange entrepreneur and makes a shit ton of money as a result. He makes like millions and millions and millions a year. It's... fucking
do big. You just want to say what an orange in term that word is?
No, it's just when someone plants oranges and sell them to bigger companies.
Thought you meant like money laundering. No. I was like, oh,
I mean, he was involved in money laundering too, but not with the oranges, I think.
Yeah. So let me just explain the orange thing now that I brought it up. So guys, when people use other people to launder money. So let's say I use Carol to launder my illegal money. Carol is the orange. That's what people use as a word in Brazil. Don't ask me why. I have no explanations.
Probably because of oranges. Because if you guys didn't know, also, the more you know, most of the oranges in your orange juice come from Brazil.
The more you know.
From São Paulo. Yeah, the more you know.
From São Paulo, really?
Yeah, a lot of it. Because the soil, like the...
they call it's it the good soil for... soil. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's really good for oranges and other kinds of stuff. But, I mean, it's good. It's a good venture. Good business venture. So, back in the clinic, his approach is still anything for a baby. He's still focused on the numbers and just the numbers. He wants to make as many babies as possible. However, he does almost no exams before he starts the treatment. So, the couples would go to him and he would start basically right away, the same day, basically. So, of course, IVFs already have a great failure rate. And for abdominal C, it wasn't really any different. He might have been a little better than other doctors, but because he was so careless, you know, you didn't have good chances, basically. So he started offering other options because he was so invested in making as many babies as possible. And he didn't know what problems the couples had because there's no exams or anything. So he starts offering some unconventional forms of treatment, like buying eggs and sperm, buying embryos, getting a surrogate, who I don't think is very legal in Brazil, and even more unconventional stuff, like using his own sperm.
Excuse me.
Yeah, yikes. So let's pause here and talk about what the treatments were actually like. So I couldn't find a whole detailed description of everything that happened in the clinic, like from the moment you walked in to the moment you walked out holding a baby. But this is what I have been able to gather based on my previous knowledge about IVFs and the testimony of the victims. Okay, so the way IVF works is, I mean, I'm no expert on it, but so the couple goes through three treatments with hormones, drugs, and everything. The eggs and the sperm are collected. Multiple embryos are generated outside the body and then put inside the uterus. So a lot of the times you need multiple tries. So that's done multiple times to result in a pregnancy. And so, yeah, he would sell that treatment as a whole package, including three tries. You could buy just one or two, but he would make sure to tell you that most couples need more than one. And he would make a deal with you where if you paid three times cash, it would be cheaper than otherwise. So the prices were not fixed. They varied for every patient. But a number that gets repeated a lot is $30,000 right then and there cash. So, yeah.
Oh, so not even reais.
Not even reais, like, dollars.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of the times they seal the deal after seeing the guy only once. And you're also required to buy the drugs and everything, and the hormones, medicine, everything at the clinic. And in the quantities that he tells you to buy. So that's like, I mean, one of the victims said she had to pay like $3,000 per like ounce of hormones. Yeah. And multiple bottles because also it was like daily injections. So, yeah, obviously he is upcharging and giving women way more than they actually need. Later, it will be determined that he is making women produce more eggs than he tells them, freezing them and selling it to other couples. And the women are paying for that out of their own pockets, basically. One woman says that she was taking so many injections that after a little bit, she was in so much pain, she could barely walk. She was taken to the clinic and Roger harvested, quote, buckets of buckets, unquote, of water coming out of her through a hose.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I don't know anything about medicine, but I think this is like eggs coming out.
This is like not, I don't think that's what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah, not at all.
So, do I go next?
Mm.
Okay. So, through the 90s, he had multiple people come forward and report him to the board for false advertising because he would promise results that didn't come. Mm-hmm. He was also reported for overcharging. He had a sexual abuse victim come forward also in 1997, saying that he had kissed her and groped her without her consent. But none of that ever led to any serious punishment because he had enough money to pay the best lawyers and connections on the inside that would always remain loyal to him. None of the allegations made it to the media.
Yep.
So that's a big thing about Brazil, not only with sexual abuse and like sexual harassment. Not only do they blame the victim, but if the person being accused is rich enough, then tough luck. Oh, he raped you? Boo-hoo. Yeah. That's pretty much the feeling.
And abdominal C was not just rich. He was a TV personality, you know? He was a famous person. It was like, if... Let's say Dr. Oz starts raping, everybody goes into his show. You're going to believe people or you're going to believe Dr. Oz? You know what I mean?
And most of the Brazilian public typically sides with the man. Yeah. Like, can I just sidebar for 1 second? Because I was so fucking heated in the comment section. So recently, this woman went on a date. You've probably seen that, Carol, in the news. She is a woman in her 50s. She was talking to this guy. Yes. Talking to this guy for months online. Just like you meet someone on Tinder and you're texting for months and months. Yeah. She meets this piece of shit guy and he beats the ever living shit out of her to the point where now she needs to have reconstructive surgery to like fix her face. And he is in his 20s. So in the comment section, all of this in Portuguese because it happened in Brazil, people are like, well, of course, like, of course she was going to get beat up. Old people don't like... Basically, she should have looked at herself in the mirror and, like, really thought about whether a young guy would have asked her out. Like, in all of this, like, all of this fucked up story, people still find a way to blame the victim. So that's the mentality of Brazilians and Latinos. A lot of Latinos are like that, so.
And also, I mean, I should have written down that down here, but in 1994, there was a big case in Brazil, similar to the McMartin preschool case here, that it was actually fabricated accusations. So it was like a period of time, like in the 90s following that case, that people didn't really believe any abuse allegations. So it was an unfortunate time, and it seems to me, and a lot of people say that the rapes that Abdelma C did on the clinic got worse in the 90s when he became famous.
Yeah, so...
Especially, yeah.
Yeah. So after years of being a stuck-up, arrogant asshole, that image started catching up to him. He was known for not giving a shit about his patients, so people were choosing other more caring doctors. So his publicist suggested to him that he should do some pro bono treatments. Roger then got super offended. He said that he would never do something like that because poor patients would scare the rich away.
Of course.
Which is not that much of a lie, because like poor people get kicked out of malls in rich neighborhoods in Brazil all the time. So, so since we're talking about his personality, let's talk a little bit about his family. Our impression is that he has a wife and kids just as a front to seem like the cute family man, but surprise, surprise, he's a piece of shit. He had a wife, Sonia, who was even battling cancer. 5 grown children, including 2 adopted kids, Soraya and Vicente, who today are both doctors. They said that they were never treated as his kids. They never felt a connection with him. They worked for the clinic, and the relationship was more of a boss-employee kind, which is so sad.
Yeah.
He cheated on Sonia with several women while she was sick, and probably for years and years before. Fucked up. That's like... Like, cheating is, like, already fucked up, but, like, to do that with someone that's battling cancer, like... So, one of the women he cheated on her with was Larissa Sacco, an attorney general or a state attorney. We don't really know anything about her. Anyways, she would become his wife later on. In 2006, in this wonderful corner of the internet called Orkut... You know what? Orkut was a thing here. One of my coworkers was in it, and she told me that they pronounced it different in English, but I forgot, forgot how it's pronounced. It's like weird. It doesn't even sound like the same.
No.
Yeah.
We're talking about Orkut, the Russian social media website.
Orkut. Yes. That's how we say it in Portuguese.
Have you guys ever noticed that me and Steph pronounce the R's differently?
Yes.
Yeah, trivia for you. We have different accents. Yeah, there you go. Go on.
So in that website, which is like Facebook, a community of women came together and started sharing stories of sexual abuse coming from Roger, and a Blogspot blog was created where under pseudonyms, the victims put everything on the table.
So this is where, when you're going to you know, star when you skip if you're gonna get bothered. No, how can I put this in a nice way? If you think that
triggered.
Yeah, if those topics are triggering for you, this is when we start with the descriptions. Okay, so everything that we said before this was not as heavy as we're gonna say now. So okay, skip, hit it 5 times, and we're gonna see you on the other side of this. Okay,
we're not gonna get offended, guys. Oh, no. just do it. No, like, it's fine. You have to look out for yourself. So
oh, yeah,
just skip it. Yeah.
So right now we'll include some of the testimonies, like we said before. But here is what happened to the victims, and like a linear narrative. So obviously he wouldn't do anything to his celebrity patients. He would do it only to women who were the most desperate to have a child, or who were well off but not that rich, or both. Anyways, almost every single victim reports him being overly friendly, touching them way too much, being flirtatious, and forcing, quote, wet kisses. When they were collecting or implanting the genetic material, he would sedate them as his procedure, and rape them as they were laying there at the gynecologist apparatus. So, you know, legs up, kind of thing, if you're a woman, you know. So he would switch between holes, and that would bring serious health complications for a lot of the victims. A lot of them almost died because of that, because he did anal and then vaginal, and that is not recommended at all. And he's a doctor, dude. He knows.
A fucking piece of
shit. So sometimes they would wake up feeling kind of weird, and would just kind of brush it off, thinking it is a hallucination. But other times they would wake up in the middle of the act, and they just couldn't ignore it. It would not be fair to say that they didn't do anything about it. A lot of them did go to the police right after it happened, but most were flat out ignored. A lot of them, though, chose to go through with the treatments, because sometimes they even blamed themselves for what happened, and they thought that he was the best of the best, and they had no nowhere else to turn to, that was their last hope as to having a kid. So, yeah. If it hasn't hit you how sad this case is until now, there you have it. It's like the saddest. It was really hard to research this for me personally. It's fucking awful. So, by the end of 2007, the story had reached his doctor friends, and his name was being dragged through the mud, and more women were coming forward, and he had no idea who they were, and he couldn't do anything to stop them because they're all anonymous. They had no faces to them. You know, all he could do was just say that it was all made up by people who were jealous of him, and women who were mad because their treatment was not effective and they never got kids, kind of thing. So when it all reaches the surface, it's not like one single sequence of events just transpired. You know what I mean? Like, it was kind of snowball, bowling ball, several bowling balls hitting him in the head at once.
Remember Sonia, his wife? She was aware of the allegations and of her husband's character. So she approached one of the clinic's employees, Cristiani. That's so funny. No, that it's not funny. Like, I'm sorry. I got too excited. Cristiani was my dad's dentist name when I was little. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was the most beautiful name ever.
Aww.
Until I reached like 7 and I was like, that's not a beautiful name. Anyway. And so Sonia told her to keep an eye on Roger and to tell her if something suspicious happened. Well, one day, Roger called her into his office and tried to kiss her, force a kiss on her.
Mm-hmm.
She was able to escape and quit her job. Sonia now knew exactly what had been rumored to happen for years and years was 100% true.
So that's something that's very fucked up about this case. Everyone knows what happens with him. Everyone knows, yeah. But nobody has the balls to come out and say. Yeah. That's fucking terrifying.
So Cristiani then contacts one of the women that she suspected were abused by Roger just weeks before her. She had seen her storm out of the clinic, calling him a perv, and she never returned. As it turns out, she was the one spearheading the Okuch community, writing under the pseudonym Iris Saga. We're including her testimony later on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good time to say here that it's not like the victims had not tried to take action against Hodge. They couldn't find lawyers that wanted to take the case. Some had spent all of their savings on treatments and had no money to face the legal battle, really. They thought they were alone. They felt guilty. And most of all, their narratives were completely ignored by the authorities. In 2008, the complaints reached the courts. Sonia died. Oh, mm-hmm. And he was out telling people that he was a dom, aka a dad and a mom for his kids. Oh, I thought that he meant like a dom, like BDSM. Why would you be telling people that? Okay. But a few short months after he became a widower, he was already in a public relationship with Larissa Sacco, and he married her soon after.
Another bitch in this case. We're going to get to her, but she's awful.
Yeah. So the story also reached the media, but taking only a few sentences, like, there are allegations against the famous doctor, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was very, like, they were oversimplifying things.
Yeah.
The story also reached a woman called Teresa, who in the 70s, when she had chronic kidney stones, and while she was in the same hospital Hodger worked at, was put on a 2-bed hospital room by herself by you know who. And she was molested for days. When he absolutely had to put another person in the room with her, he purposely chose someone who was blind and kept everything going. Oh my God, that's awful. But can you imagine, like, blind people can hear really well. So that person, like, just had to lay there and, like, listen to it. So she ran away from the hospital. Hodger even called her afterwards to threaten to kill her if she dared come forward. Back in 1997, she came out to her family after a beloved TV show of ours, Fantástico, did a story about an orthopedist who was sexually abusing his patients. Right after that, they aired another story about IVFs featuring Hodger and sucking his balls, basically saying that he was the best doctor and all of that. The very next day after the story aired, a woman called the channel to report that Abdelmassih had sexually abused her. Her testimony, however, was ignored because of all of that had happened back in the 70s, which is that whole thing of like, well, why didn't you come forward then? Blah, blah, blah. Teresa then decided to come out, and this time she was finally taken seriously.
So a journalist called Lilian Cristofoletti at the Folha de São Paulo newspaper, she had a close friend who was seeking Roger for IVF treatments. So she kind of commented passing that some women were coming out with allegations against him, but nobody believes them. So the journalist starts working on that story. She goes after 9 of the victims, including the employee of the clinic that had come out to the police, and convinced them to come out publicly to the media. At that point, everything was still anonymous. The victims didn't have much contact with each other because they're still building the case. And she even talked to Hajar at the clinic, and he was very asshole-ish with the interview. He even asked her to grab his arm to see if he would, if he stood any chance as to, you know, forcing anyone to do anything, saying that the women are crazy. And there's no way an old man like me could do anything like that. Perfect. So she came out with the story before the investigations were over. And it was the last news story she actually ever did. She retired after that. That's a cool way to close it, right?
Oh, okay. I thought that she was like blacklisted. Okay, no, she retired. No, so no, I'm
she
good.
She was good. So this is the part of the story that we're going to include the testimonies of the victims. All right. So again, if you're triggered, I hate saying like that, if you're triggered, you know what I mean? Because it sounds liberal I zone hear you. Kind of thing, though, if you're going to feel
Yeah, because people have like associated triggered with like being overly sensitive, but we actually mean like if you're triggered. Okay, so here is me reading the testimony of the victim. I was about to do a voice, but I don't think I can keep up with a different voice. So the persuasion starts as soon as you walk into his office. You see a white wall filled with pictures of babies, celebrity babies. He starts the appointment with a casual conversation, and he uses that to gather information about your life. You talk about business, economy, all to find out how well to do you are. He talks about money, religion, everything. He does the whole thing holding a rosary, and he says that he doesn't do anything, that he doesn't actually do anything, that it's all God. He's a very, very captivating person. He makes you feel like there's no reason not to trust him. He asks my husband and I to do some blood work, and a person comes in to collect it. That very same day, we get the result. He tells my husband he has azoospermia. That means no sperm in the semen. And that is a result we had not had before, and that I had a problem where I had to remove my tubes. We had gone to the office that day just for a consultation. We were not sure if we wanted to do anything, so we started talking about cost. We thought it was way too expensive. We told him that we couldn't pay, so he asked, how much is your dream worth? How much is a child calling you daddy worth? Don't you have horses? You can sell a horse. We closed the deal. We paid $30,000 for 3 tries, not including the medicine we had to buy at the clinic. We couldn't buy it elsewhere. 2 days later, I did the surgery. 10 days later, I went to the clinic by myself to remove the stitches. There, I was seen by an assistant that really hurt me while doing the procedure. When I was walking out of that room, I walked by Hodges' office. I saw that he was there, and he saw me. He invited me in, and I complained about the assistant. I was crying. He hugged me, and I thought nothing of it. He walked with me, so no one could see us through the open door, forced me against the wall, and tried to kiss me. His smell lingered on me. I left. I told my husband what had happened, and he wanted to go there to talk to the guy, but here's what was going through my mind. First, I had already paid for the treatments, and second, I was feeling like I was guilty that I must have given him the wrong impression. So we started a treatment. But the day-to-day was not that hard because we hardly ever saw him. It was just the assistants. I went there for 40 days, every single day. I always saw the same women every day in the waiting room with me, but we weren't allowed to talk to each other. If we did, he would step out of his room to shush us. He was captivating and charismatic only when he was trying to sell you something. On the day of collecting the eggs, I was put on a gynecological position with him and an assistant in the room. I took some medicine to relax because your uterus cannot contract during the procedure, but it is not something that puts you out. It just makes you sleepy. When I woke up, I had a feeling he had sex with me. I thought a lot, sat up, got dressed, and was thinking to myself that I must be mistaken. He tried to kiss me. I must have had some type of trauma. It's nothing. 10 days later, I went back there for a pregnancy test, and it was negative, but I still had another 2 tries. I had to buy all the medicine again and do the procedure all over again. But this time, when I woke up, he was on top of me. I sat up all dirty, yelled for the nurse. He dressed back up and left. To explain what you feel at that moment is just, I can't find the words. I can't wish it on anyone, especially because I was looking for my child. I left crying, told my husband it was because I was in pain. I still had to come back there, and it was another negative. One more try to go. I told my husband what happened on a trip and said that I would not be coming back to that clinic. Today, I can talk about it, but it wasn't always like that. I would be lying to you if I told you that I'm all right. As a woman, I'll carry that for the rest of my life. I thought it was just me. I thought he was the only one that would be able to help me fulfill my dream. He was supposed to be the best, but we tried again. He went to a clinic in Campinas to try it with 2 young doctors, and they were trying to find out what other clinic had I gone to. I said it was Abdelmasi, and they knew right away why I had given up. The doctor had been an intern on the clinic, and he told me that I wasn't alone. I got pregnant on the first try with my triplets, 2 boys and a girl. God is fair, because today I have the confidence that Roger is not the father of my kids. When I came out, my life was chaos. My business went down under. My career plummeted. I even got life threats. I understand why only a few women came out. When I went to the authorities, the impression I had is that I had raped him. It was hard. They do everything as if I was lying. He was arrested, but he was let go. That was terrifying, especially because before all of this, we were anonymous. But now he knew exactly who we were. He knew our faces because they were on TV. I'm not here for revenge. I'm just here for justice. And this was the first victim to come out. Her name was Ivani Serebrenik.
We started out in 87. There was no treatments like that where I lived. My ex-husband had done a surgery with abdominoplasty, and he was just starting to do some IVFs. He invited my husband to do the treatment with him with the guise of researching and improvements for the treatments. We moved to Campinas and started it all in 91. On the second appointment, had an individual appointment with Roger in his office. So he started to say nasty things about my then husband, saying that he was only using me as an incubator. He told me that he was there for me, and I saw him as a father figure then. He told me that he was also sterile and made up a story about his life. He got up and asked where I wanted to date at, in São Paulo or in Campinas. And I said, well, isn't there where you have the clinic and all the equipment? And he said, no, I mean the intimate date. So I got up and he threw me against the wall. I fought back, kicked his balls, and was able to run away. I came back though, just to tell him that I was telling my husband. He dared me to do so. It would be my word against his. I kept going with the treatments, and he did to me what he did to the others. I thought about coming out, but he makes it seem like you depend on him. He said he would tell people that it was me that tried to seduce him. He treated us like puppets.
That was Valesca Spinelli, one of the first patients he did IVFs on. So this next one is the first documented victim that we have, Teresa. We talked about her already, but this is her case in her own words. I think it's important to add, you know.
I was a minor at the time, and Hajar would abuse me 4 to 5 times a day. I was illiterate, poor, and afraid. Who wouldn't be afraid? He threatened me and my family. This is why I didn't press any charges back then. I didn't have any doors open for me to do that. He would do the absolute worst things that you could do to a woman, especially a young, virgin, simple girl like I was. A friend of mine came to visit me at the hospital, and I just asked her, "Do you know how to run?" And I didn't even tell her why. I just began taking all the needles and everything out of my arms. He came back into the room, asked who my friend was, and asked her if she had come on a car. When she answered that she had taken the bus, he told us that he would call a friend to pick us up. When he said that, I just ran. Thank God I got rid of him. I was afraid of everything and everyone. I was afraid of dating. I remember that horrible, stinky man, and it hurts. I don't like talking about this, but it's necessary. Coming out as a victim liberated me from the weight and dirty feeling that I had. I felt dirty. I still do. It feels like his smell is still on me.
In 1993, the woman who became the main face of the victim, Savannah, went to Roger Abdelmasi for treatments. She was abused, and right afterwards, she went to the police station to press charges. Surprise, nothing happened. When everything resurfaced, when the allegations were coming out, when she went back to like the police station and stuff to proceed her case, no one could find the report. Can you believe? The paper, like, wow. they couldn't find any paper trail for the case. Eventually, after like the not Vanna, but everyone making like a mess in the office, the paperwork would magically appear in one of the bathrooms of the building. Vanna had 10 embryos of hers implanted into other women. So this woman was not only raped, she has 10 kids out there that she's probably never going to know who they are, you know? That's the most terrifying thing I ever heard. So also one of the victims, Silvia Franco, she had a miscarriage and she passed the fetus on a toilet. When she called him to ask what she should do, he told her to grab it and put it on the fridge so he could get a chance to look at it. She also had several embryos implanted into other women.
Wow.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
No, that's really disgusting. So in 2009, the then president Dilma Rousseff passed a law that equated any sexual crime to the crime of rape. Before that, it was only rape if there was penetration. Right after, an arrest warrant is issued for the arrest of Abdelmasi on 54 counts of rape. He was arrested in August of 2009 as a preventative measure since he was probably going to try to run away. He was released on December 24th to await his trial in liberty through a habeas corpus request. Following the argument that a preventative arrest was useless since he wasn't working on the clinic anymore and he had his license revoked, so therefore he couldn't rape anyone else. That hearing was done by the minister, Gilmar Mendes, hearing only the defense, not the prosecution, so there was no counter arguments. Obviously, he won.
Yeah, it was Christmas Eve. They didn't call the prosecution. They just called the defense for the hearing. So there was no counter arguments. It was just one side. If there's something fishy in this earth, it's that. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you guys need to keep in mind with this case, and this is when the whole background information starts getting a lot more important. This guy has a shit ton of connections. This guy is like a fucking...
In every level of society.
Every level of society. This is... I mean, Gilmar Mendes, the minister that hosted the hearing, whatever. He's not... he's kind of famous, too. Like, he is on several other cases, including corruption cases. Tons of stuff. His name is popular. He has a huge Wikipedia page. I kind of looked at it, and I kind of recognized some stuff. But he has his finger in a lot of stuff, and this is one of the bad things of the bunch of stuff he has done for the Brazilian society. So, yep.
So, in 2010, the case against him is still going strong. After hearing hundreds of testimonies of witnesses and victims and a three-hour-long sob story by Jorge, it wasn't going to be a jury trial because when it comes to sexual crimes in Brazil, the decision is made only by a judge. Which, no comment. Her decision, the judge, was that he should be sentenced to 278 years in jail, 6 years for every confirmed victim. He was accused of 56 crimes, but only 48 of those were accepted. Because of the habeas corpus, he couldn't be sent to a closed regimen facility.
I think that means that he can like go home. Or like
house arrest?
Yeah, no, not like house arrest, not yet. But that I think he like has to like kind of be in prison, but he could be out of prison for like a long time. You know what I mean? Like he just sort of lives in prison, but not really.
Yeah.
So for any effects, he's not arrested then because of a habeas corpus. It's the way the system works. I don't know. I don't really understand it. So in 2011, it reached the years of the justice system that Abdelmasi had renewed his passport. So to make sense, that does not have anything to do with the Brazilian government because he had double citizenship. He was Lebanese. So his passport was Lebanese. So it's possible that the Brazilian government immigration had no idea that he had done that, you know? So obviously... They are, like, freaking out, like, oh my god, this guy's gonna split, you know, he's gonna run. So when they go look for him, he's not there anymore. Yeah.
Hmm.
He ran. You guys, he ran away. So Larissa at this point is pregnant with twins, and they were suspecting that they ran to Lebanon or possibly Italy or any other European countries. And he even made it to the Interpol most wanted list. He has children that live like in Europe and stuff. So it's, they, I mean, it said that they see Hajar on like casinos in Paris.
So he's not even trying to be subtle. No. He's just like, yep, goodbye. Yeah. Let me go to a casino.
Yeah.
Immediately after running away.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really confirmed that he is there, but I don't feel it's a stretch. You know, he has kids up there, you know. He could fucking go through no problem without being, you know, so I don't think it's too much of a stretch. So the investigations, though, were focused on the properties he had in the countryside, remember, with the oranges, to possibly find where the world is Carmen Sandiego, right? But what they find instead is tons of debt and sketchy businesses on his rural, another word I can say, rural.
I fucking hate that word. Country. Rural.
Ventures, but also money laundering and severe medical malpractice. Surprise. So they find that the genetic material that was used on the clinic was very, very sketchy, meaning that they don't know where the sperm and eggs come from. And, you know, we already said that he was using his own sperm and harvesting eggs on women and stuff. And that is proven for at least one of the couples that he used sperm that was not from the father. That, I mean, this is all kind of allegations. I don't really have that much proof, but it's, I mean, this happens with one person, happened with many, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Hajar had to pay some reparations for them, but it's not clear that the sperm was his or not. And as one of the investigators on the case puts it, this is some information that no one wants to investigate. No one wants to come find out if he is the dad or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, I want to know for the gossip. But I respected that, you know, it's fucking awful.
Yeah, no, I understand why people would be like, no thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So he was on the run now with a very pregnant Larissa. No one knows where he was, obviously. The victims and the public in general have no faith that the justice system will catch him again. So the victims organize and run a parallel investigation, handling their results to the police. It's very possible that without them, he would still be on the run. Another group of people that was running their own investigation was the media. Leandro Santana for this show called Domingo Espectacular, which is like a sort of like a knockoff version of Fantástico.
Yeah.
He got really, really close, almost finding him at the country house in Avaré. But when he got there with the police, he had just left, like literally just left. They found all their prized belongings, designer clothes, wedding dress, family pictures, everything was there. Rumor has it they had water still warm on the kettle, ready to make tea. They had just missed them.
Yeah. Someone had tipped off that they were coming. The investigators were coming in. They left fast. So let me explain how they actually found Hajar. Okay, I didn't write anything else, so it's going to be kind of funny. I'm sorry. So what happened is they kind of went through multiple fronts. First, they found out that they kind of looked through the schools to look for Brazilian kids and didn't find anything. But they found that Larissa had kind of signed up for an American school, like a bilingual school that was very prestigious. And she was kind of like waiting for their place, waiting for like a spot for the kids at the school. And they found that she had registered for that. So they kind of suspected that the kids were in other American schools of the region. So they found this small one that had two twins, you know, because not, yeah, you know what I mean? A set of twins fitting the around same age, two years old. And so they kind of like start narrowing it down. Then they find a prayer group, like an informant, informs them of a peer group that a guy fitting Hajar's profile goes to. And they're able to talk to, like, the priest that runs the prayer group. And he's like, oh, yeah, like, this guy here, he's an orange farmer. his name? I don't know. And they go like, well, his wife, what's her name? Lara. And it's like, oh yeah, Larissa. You know what I mean? Like, the priest knows. They kind of like didn't feed him information, but they collected it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they find where the spirit group was held. They follow, because this is like around the same time that the twins are about to have a birthday party. And they mm-hmm. find out that the lady that hosts the prayer group is going to the birthday party. Right? So,
bullshit.
Yeah. So they need to kind of find where the guy lives. And they kind of already know, but not really. You know what I mean? And that's how they find the house. You know?
And all of this took years, guys. All of this, it wasn't like overnight.
All of this took years. And it was the combined efforts of the victims, the journalists, and the police. But I think more of the unofficial investigations rather than the official ones. So they the whole challenge of this is they cannot get him inside of his house. So it's like, yeah, they found his house, why didn't they just storm in, you know? Well, because they were intercepting their phone calls, and they knew that Hodgett had bought guns and he was intending to kill himself if he was caught at home.
So
the plan is they were going to wait until they leave the house to get Hodger, you know, kind of not noticing that he was investigated or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it takes like a few days for them to get it, but he is arrested like after he drops his kids off at school one day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, he... I was gonna say, yeah, and they find out that he has like 4 burner phones that he distributed. Like, I think only a few people had it. It was like one of his kind of like a secretary administrator or something for the country houses,
mm-hmm.
and one for the one for like Larissa's sister, one for like friends, whatever. And he, like, these 4 burner phones is the only way that he would communicate with people. And he would always like use different phone numbers from all over the world. Like, he would use a program that shuffles all that. So he was being careful. But you know who wasn't being careful?
Larissa,
of course. She was ordering like dresses and shit to be delivered to her sister in Jabuticabal. You know, she had like a pharmacy there. So she would like order stuff, and Hodger would do that too, but it was gonna be like less obvious things, like envelopes of money instead of like, you know, pretty dresses. So they would order stuff to be delivered to the pharmacy, which is very suspicious already, you know what I mean? And the things would be like sent to like several stops before they got to Asuncion, which it makes it harder to track, but it was trackable in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're moving thousands and thousands of fucking guys. It's no way you're not going to be tracked. It took 3 years, but was tracked. And they found what Larissa's phone number was on the like phone book or whatever. And like they called, they got someone to call the phone number, and they asked like, yo, is whoever there? And she was like, no, she's not here, because obviously it wasn't Larissa's name. So it's like, oh, it's, I don't know, Maria. Is Maria there? And Larissa was like, no, it's not her, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But it was clearly someone who didn't speak Spanish. Like, her Spanish is the worst Spanish. It's worse than mine. Honestly, my Spanish is like not good. It was like, oh, no se encuentra. And I'm like, fucking... just try a little bit, you know? So, can you believe that if you, like, that number that they got, they put it on WhatsApp, and, like, she had a profile picture, like, her selfie, like, her face.
What a fucking idiot. What?
It's fucking, I mean, it's people that they don't think they're ever gonna get caught, you know?
So.
It's fucking awful.
So, as you can tell, they found Roger. I was about to say Roger. Roger. Living a very comfortable life in Asunción, Paraguay. He was paying $11,000 a month in rent for a 3-story mansion with a pool and whatnot. At 1976 Guido Spano Street, San Cristobal, which is a neighborhood of Asunción, Oh, here's my mom bringing me. Every time I'm recording, my mom brings me food. Like, she'll just, like, slide the food in. Like,
oh, I wish I had my mom anyway. Bring me food.
Oh. So, where was I? Okay, so this is a neighborhood of Asunción. He was living using the alias Ricardo Galeano, who claimed to be a social investor, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah.
He had his two kids there, always ate at the best restaurants, had nannies, maids, drivers, everything. The servers of a restaurant he was a regular at knew him as the old man who would always get the most expensive wine bottles, 500, 600 reais, which is like $100, $150, which is like a crazy amount of money for a freaking wine bottle. He would always sit at tables where he could see whoever walked through the door and would leave immediately after hearing people speaking Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
It is speculated that Paraguay was initially a temporary fix, that he would stay there for a little bit before moving more permanently to Lebanon. We don't know why he decided to stay, probably because he thought he could get away with it and never get caught there in a, quote, cheap city where everyone loves Brazilians. So why would he move to Lebanon? Him and Larissa, can I stop? Him and Larissa.
Larissa, where's my flowers? I'm sorry, I didn't do it.
Never had any jobs or monetary activity in Paraguay. They lived off the money that was being sent to them from Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
He looked into opening / investing in a restaurant in Asunción and even wanted to open a clinic there. Ooh, can you imagine that?
Can you imagine? I mean, two things to add. I think that they were kind of... this is my theory, all right? Me, Carol, my theory. Because they were invested in putting the kids through English American schools. This is something that's very popular with expats in Latin America, or like with people that, you know, example, like I know people that didn't, the like immigrant life didn't work out here in America and they go to other places. They go to, they put their kids into American schools, bilingual, because they're already used to it. And I mean, you cannot find like, you know, German schools anywhere, but you can find American schools anywhere. You know what I mean? So as a way for the kids to adapt to better, you know, to different places. So I think that they're planning to leave Paraguay eventually, you know, and that putting the kids in American schools will get them habituated with speaking English and stuff, so they could live anywhere in the world, basically. Because it's easier to learn English than learning Arabic or, you know.
Oh, hell yes. Although, to all my fellow Arabic-speaking friends there, which I have a few of them, there's a lot of words in Arabic that are very similar to Portuguese
words. I know, right? It's amazing.
Which is crazy. I was telling my dad about this the other day, and he was like, isn't it crazy how, like, the most random languages will have, like, similar words? I'm like, yeah.
I know, God, right?
I know.
Yeah.
When he was brought back to Brazil, some of his victims were at the airport waiting for him. One of them looked him straight into his eyes and whispered, welcome to hell.
She didn't whisper. Oh, can you imagine yelled, that? Welcome to hell.
Listen, whispering sounds more threatening.
Yeah, she,
welcome to hell.
She yelled, welcome to hell. There's no minister that's going to get you out of here now.
So
badass, he makes, right? Bad
he makes
ass.
It big on the media again, this time with the leaked phone conversations. One of his friends who was sending him money, Rui Marco Antonio, who was the director, owner of one of the biggest hospitals in São Paulo, São Luís. And here's a bit of what Roger told him. So can you make a Roger voice and say okay. That, Carol?
But since it's in third person, so I'm just going to... So his kids and his wife are his reason to live. Not his grown kids, his little kids, the two kids he just had. He makes fun of the reward that they have for his capture, saying that he's worth more. It's like $10,000, but he's worth more than that.
What a fucking narcissist.
Yeah. He calls the victim sons of bitches, or daughters of bitches, anyway. And he says that they have mental problems. He speaks in metaphors, like a fucking sphinx, almost. And it's really tough to understand sometimes. I don't know if because it's old, or because, you know, the way he talks, I don't know. But here's what he says about the victims, right? I passed the women on the back constantly. Probably thought that everything was available. they would throw the corn, I would eat it, and now I'm getting the iron. You know, women are disgraced animals, really.
What?
Yeah, meaning I thought the goods were available to me. They were seducing me. I just did what they wanted, and now I'm getting punished by it. That's what he thinks.
So happened. You just tripped, and you fell right inside their vaginas as they are unconscious.
Whoopsie. Yeah, no thanks. So he has never confessed. He still feels to this day that he was falsely accused. That is his defense, that the women were hallucinating or just making it all up. So let's address that for a second. First of all, yes, a lot of abuse happened when the victims were not at all conscious. So you might be thinking like, well, how do they know? How do they remember? How do they know it happened? Okay. But yes, the drug used was propofol, and it was determined in scientific studies that the chances of getting hallucinations from it are about the same as winning the lotto. So it will not happen as often as it did in the clinic, you know, if they were getting hallucinations from it. And also, when it does happen, they're non-negative hallucinations. So, you know, they would have probably dreamed that, you know, Hauser was blowing balloons at them, not raping them. Yeah. Also, he says that the women were just frustrated because they couldn't get pregnant. They didn't get what they wanted, so they're just getting back at him. But there's a good number of victims that actually did get pregnant at the clinic and were still raped and they're still coming out. So he does have the best of the best lawyers, but there's just no way you can defend him. There's no way. He expressed on the phone calls that he wanted to go to Tremembé because he had contacts in there. And that is exactly what happens when he is brought to Brazil.
So he's a real, what's the equivalent of a husband? No, what's like the opposite of housewife?
Husband?
He's not a real housewife of Tremembé. He's a real house husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there like an opposite, like an antonym? Not antonym. A male synonym for housewife?
Equivalent of housewife, I don't know.
Because I plan on being the rich spouse. I plan on being, my husband can stay home and, like, clean and take care of the kids. So I don't want to be the housewife. I want to be the breadwinner. So what's the husband's going to be? I don't know.
I don't know.
Slave boy.
Talk about housewives. Larissa didn't really get any charges because facilitating the escape of her spouse is not a crime in Brazil.
Are you kidding me?
No, this is actually true. She didn't get anything. She was on the run with him.
Well, but she's poor now, right? Because they took away the money.
Wait. In August 29th, 2017, he left Tremembé and he was put on house arrest.
What?
Yeah. For reasons of his failing health and good behavior while in the prison. He's now 80-something, and he has no money, no glory, no nothing. He lives in Larissa's apartment, and he is, like, a fucking dead person. Like, you look at pictures of him, he's, like, not doing well at all, which he deserves that.
Question. Can I pose as a pizza delivery driver, show up there, and then just egg him? Like, literally? Yes. Egg him?
Yes. Okay, no pun intended. Again.
I didn't even think of that. Yeah. Come on.
This episode's going to be like, what do eggs, and eggs have in common? Because we don't have anything funny to say.
Yeah, and it's all different kinds of eggs. So yeah. It's not like we're repeating ourselves.
I mean, we're putting way too many hind eggs. I guess another Easter egg in this podcast. How many times can we talk about eggs in this show? So, his children are not named in the media, his two little kids, and his two grown adopted kids come out always in the defense of the victims. They removed the Abdelma C from their names, and they go by their biological last names, I guess you could call that now. The son, what's his name, Vicente, he was the owner of 1% of the clinic, and he actually had to face all the consequences, business-wise, of the case by himself.
Oh,
owner
sucks.
Of 1% of the business.
That's not fair.
Not fair at all. Yeah. So another thing that's really, I mean, not gonna say it's good that came out of this case, because I mean, I think for any negatives, you know, we're negatives, there's always something positive that comes out, is the victims. Because for a long time, they were very anonymous. But after Hodger kind of challenges them to come out and show their faces, they do come out and they are very vocal about the kind of thing in the media. They get awards. They are very, very present in a way. And Vanna, I think we talked about her here, right? She created a Facebook group and like an organization. I think she has even has plans to become like an NGO at some point. Of it's the page is called Victims United, Vítimas Unidas, and it's not just for victims of abdomacy, but it's for victims of, as she puts it, like any kind of domestic violence. Any kind of rape, any kind of crime that you're a victim of. She has that page so she can, like, it's not her, but so you can proceed with the case in 100% the right way. So there's no way that the person is going to be freed, you know? So she has a victim support network all built to every kind of victim out there. And that's really cool. That's really good that she's still doing that kind of work, you know?
You know, do they also, like, expose abusers on that that victim's page?
I don't know.
You know?
They might.
Because a lot of... Okay, this is, like, not even... I don't think my comment is relevant right now, but... A lot of men and women, too, they run away from Brazil, like, who have committed, like, crimes like this. And not all the time. They're not always reported, but they just leave Brazil and they move here. And they proceed to do the same thing here. And then they get deported. I feel like there should be a page or, like, a section of, like, a website like that that exposes people who are deported from other countries for sex crimes. Like the town I used to live in, which like near where I live at right now, this woman had an in-house daycare and her husband was raping the kids there.
No, really?
For like, for years. And it came out last year and he's in like deportation proceedings. He's in jail right now.
Oh my God.
But I think it would be very useful that once he's deported, he's exposed. Because it was a big story here.
Jesus Christ.
And, like, and the wife knew about it. Because she, like, would be like, oh, I'm going to take a nap. Can you watch the kids? And he was, like, a reported rapist in Brazil. So she knew that, like, she shouldn't just leave the kids with him. Yeah.
I swear.
So anyway, that was my 2 cents.
That fucking sucks. So, as we said before, we always want to be about the victims here. So, I guess it's a good, a good taste to end this episode with two quotes of the victims. So, this first one is by Teresa's like in her 60s right now, the first victim that was abused. I'm not going to say the first that was abused by him, because probably not, but the first documented case. So, I cried when I heard, there's a video of her saying, and she's like an old lady talking about that. So, rape culture will only stop when machismo stops, when women stop being looked at as objects. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of men who see women as objects they can just use whenever and however they want. And it's not just because I'm a woman that I have to be ready to go. It has to be mutual. Fucking old lady. I love her so much. I love her so much. So, and Vanna, the Victims United spearheading, she's like the leader of the victims group. She says that there's never just one victim of rape. Rapists rape many, many people. So never think that you're the only one. You're never alone. There's always going to be someone else with you. So, yeah, it's a good place. Good thought to end this.
Exactly. And like, not every rapist also starts out raping. So, like, let's say if you were raped by John, it could be that Mary was groped by him. Like, he didn't actually rape her, but he acted sketchy, and he did something that's wrong. Another thing, I didn't write this down,
but another like victim, she's anonymous. She doesn't have a name to her, but she calls not only a call to action to protect the victims on these cases and give justice to the victims, but also to she says like, who will make us feel human again? You know? And I think that is something to think about when we're thinking about these kinds of cases where it's a, you know, we focus so much on, you know, are they, you know, telling the truth? Is this, you know, the legal aspects of it, when really who will make them feel human again? You know? Yeah. I think this is what we need to keep in mind when we are like reiterating these kinds of cases and talking about it, is that they're human after all, these victims, you know. They're people that spend years and years and years, because most of the abuse happened in the 90s, even before that, and they spent 20 years almost seeing this guy on TV every fucking weekend, partying, being praised, until it's
being praised.
I mean, you can't take it anymore, you know what I mean? And I mean, what's really sad about the victims is that most of them were not believed, not even by their families and their husbands. You know what I mean? Most of the victims, and we're talking about hundreds, Belmacy had 20,000 patients he worked at. 7,500 babies by the time he was had his license revoked. That's how many victims. Like, he was convicted for 48 of them, but there was not just 48. You know what I mean? And these people saw him like being successful. These people lost their fucking, you know, families for that. Like, most they lost. Most of them got divorced. A lot of them got serious health complications. You know, a lot of them actually became infertile after having that kind of infection and stuff, and they almost died because of fucking anal sex. Can you believe it?
Yeah, this is so. Can you say something happy now so the listeners can be like, oh my god, this is so happy?
Oh my god, let me see. What can I
do? Oh my god, I'll say it.
Okay.
My birthday's coming, guys.
Oh my god, mine too. And mine's first.
Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. Oh yeah,
mine's
Carol's first.
Yeah, I think by the time this, not by the time this episode comes out, but next week. No.
It's not, your birthday is Tuesday.
By the time next episode comes out, this is my birthday episode. The saddest case we've ever done. Carol. Happy birthday, Carol. Oh my god.
Yeah, we should do like a sad episode for my birthday too, like a really sad story, just so we can both be depressed.
Oh my god.
No, guys, but like, what are you guys going to buy Carol for her birthday? Carol's going to put her Amazon wish list on the description.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys can buy her something. And then I'll do that for my birthday.
No.
And I'm Amazon. Being dead serious.
What I'm putting is my address out there on my birthday is February the 26th. That's the Tuesday. So if you're listening to this the day it comes out, Monday, tomorrow, you're going to show up at my house. I'm going to be sitting on my front lawn on a beach chair waiting for my gifts.
Put your address. You just put your Amazon list, because then you can get anonymous gifts like this microphone.
I don't want anonymity. I want to see their face, you know?
Well, I don't want to see you guys' faces. I want the appraisal. So just send me my presents without your faces.
But I mean, one of you guys probably sent Steph a mic because you're pissed about the audio quality of this podcast. So do that again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next thing, let me see what you can send me, guys. I'm going to put my Amazon wish list, but like, I can't think of like my mom asked me, she was like, what do you want for your birthday? I was like, I don't know.
You know what I said I want for my birthday?
Mm-hmm.
Money. Are they going to give me
money? Well, I always want money.
No, they never, I always ask, they never give me money. I just
my mom gives me money.
I just want to gather all the money that I'm going to get possibly for this birthday and just buy something really expensive, you know. Buy really expensive means something that's like $100, you know, like those, you know, those facial vibrators, the what's the name, the,
yeah
the Foreo? Thing to wash your face for, what's the name,
Foreo
whatever the name, Luna, you know, those things you put. I want that. I try to do that with other things that vibrate on my house, and it didn't work, so I want the real thing.
I'll give you $5 for your 4-year fund.
That is more than anyone has ever donated to my 4-year fund. Steph, okay. I am very pleased.
You're welcome.
I love you. It means so much to me.
You're very welcome. Okay. Can you do our shout outs?
The shout outs. We haven't really done the shout outs in a while, have we? We haven't. Let me just open my fucking thing. This is the shout out little song. Okay, so short. We have Gabrielle, Laura, Jimmy, Judy, and Sydney, who all followed us on social media and deserve to be shout out because you guys are great and you're interacting with us, and that's good.
Thank you guys.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for the support. Mm-hmm. And thank you for the gifts that you're going to give Carol, because I already said you're going to give Carol gifts. So you better give her gifts. I am dead serious. I will find you and I will kill you if you don't give her gifts.
No, we're kidding. Your ears are all the presents that we want. Your ears and the...
No, I want actual physical material things.
You want actual physical ears? You know how you can never person you send a piece of the ear?
Yes. I actually want that.
Oh my god, I know, right? We can make like we get little pieces of everyone's ear and then we like stitch it all together and make like
a big ear.
Yeah. And then we like hang it up like on the fucking like wall on the recording the podcast, like do like a studio.
Yeah.
A freaking ear. Okay. Yeah.
Carol.
Definitely.
This freaking episode is too long already.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I got pee.
Okay. So yeah.
We better end this.
So, you guys, I hope you enjoyed it. I mean, we did a long episode to apologize for the kind of two short episodes that we had last couple weeks. So, you guys got our, fix of this whole thing we have going on here. So, yeah.
Yes. You're welcome.
You're welcome. Let us know if you like this kind of episode that is more not somber but not as playful and chit chatty as the other ones, you know.
Yeah. Some people think we talk a lot, my mom. So so there you go. This is for you.
This is a podcast. This is literally just talking. If you want some. Anyways, guys, thank you so much for listening. You always it's always a blast to record this, even if it's a really sad case. So, yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Can I just make one quick comment before we...
Take a drink, listeners.
Okay. So, do you guys... Well, you're not going to get the reference, listeners. But there's this Facebook... You know how you can put, like, Facebook frames on your pictures?
Yeah.
There's this new one since Bolsonaro was elected that says that if it, like, harms someone, then I would be the resistance. Mm-hmm. Se fere resistência de alguém, eu seria resistência. Mm-hmm. And the irony that my uncle... who's a fucking abusive piece of shit, put that on his profile picture. Okay, goodbye. That's all I had to say.
Yeah.
I try to end this on a good note, but I saw this and I couldn't keep myself quiet.
I mean, it's all everything that's happening in Brazil right now, there's just no way this is not like the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You know? If it honestly feels like this is a universe that was made like a fucking... You know, those artificial reality things that was just made for me to piss me off. This is exactly what that is. There's no way this is all happening. But this is another conspiracy theory for later.
We will do an episode just on that.
Yeah, exactly. Guys, it's crazy out there. So, yeah, take care, I guess. This is it.
Take care. And as Carol would say, can you say your catchphrase, Carol?
Hope you guys have a good end of the world.
Yes. Okay, I'll make you a t-shirt out of that. Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Suspiria, a true crime podcast. If you are a creep and enjoy listening to all of that horrible information, please check out our previous episodes and write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
And also follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram as Suspiria Podcast. Facebook is also Suspiria Podcast. If you want to follow Carol, you can follow her at Suspiria Carol. And you can follow me at EU.Steph. Note, none of us post anything interesting.
We do, actually.
If you have any case suggestions, feel free to drop them over at SuspiriaPodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to be part of this podcast, you can also email us. We promise we won't bite. Ciao! Suspiria.